Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is the award-winning journalist John Heilman. Heilman is a national political correspondent and columnist for New York Magazine. He is author of Before the Fall, The Trials of Bill Gates and the End of the Microsoft Era, and is co-author with Mark Halperin of the New York Times bestseller Game Change, Obama and the Clintons, McCain and Palin, and The Race of a Lifetime. It was published earlier this year by Harper. I'm talking to John Heilman by phone from Washington, D.C. John Heilman, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Now, Game Change is, of course, about the 2008 presidential election, and so much was written about it during the campaign, 24/7 news, blogs, cable shows. Why did you and Mark Halperin want to rehash this so soon?
Well, in a funny way, we agree completely that the campaign was certainly the most covered and maybe even over-covered campaign in our lifetimes, but in a funny way, the coverage was an enticement to do this rather than a discouragement. And there's, this because of the way that the campaigns are now covered in the not just 24-hour news cycle, but the nonstop, minute-by-minute, moment-by-moment blog news cycle, a lot of the most important questions about the campaign and a lot of things that people are most interested in just never really actually get resolved. There's issues that people obsess over very briefly and then move on without ever having actually answered the main question that people care about. So, Mark and I had been covering the campaign for a year and a half when we decided to do the book, and at that point we still couldn't come up with satisfactory answers to some questions that we had. I'm not talking about like super mysterious kind of questions, but really basic things like, how did Barack Obama decide to run for president, and what role did Bill Clinton play in his wife's campaign? Later on, we'd have the question of how did Sarah Palin get on the Republican ticket? And these are all questions that people talked about around water coolers and over kitchen tables and some people in the press for certain passing moments really obsessed over, but didn't really ever get to the bottom of. And partly because we felt like those were interesting questions and partly because we thought the race had been so compelling and the characters in it had been so enormous and people had been so riveted by them, and because the story itself had been so compelling, we thought, this was a historic campaign, and to be able to use the relationships with the sources that we had to be able to go back and tell the story of the candidates and their spouses, how they experienced the campaign, we thought that would be a worthy venture.
Yeah, and it is indeed. It's a riveting book, absolutely. Well, let's start with Hillary Clinton, because in 2007, even before, she was thought of as unstoppable, a juggernaut. What happened?
Oh, well, so many things happened. I mean, the main thing, of course, the most obvious thing that happened was the Iowa caucuses, but there was so much more that led up to that. She had been an ambivalent entrant into the race in a lot of ways. Despite the fact that everyone assumed that she was running in 2008, she, in fact, as we report in the book, was very uncertain about whether she wanted to get in or not. She was very happy in the Senate and very concerned about what running would do to her life. She didn't really want to go back to the Clinton Wars from the 1990s. She didn't want to put her daughter through that, among other things. And she knew that she had some real vulnerabilities at the beginning, particularly the fact that she'd voted to authorize the Iraq War. At the same time, her husband said to her, if you think you could be the best president of the United States, you should run. And so she decided to do it. But, she had spent a lot of 2006, which was a year where Barack Obama, even before he decided to run, had spent a lot of that year crisscrossing the country, campaigning on behalf of Senate candidates, building up a profile, writing a book that elevated his stature even higher than it already was. He had spent that year in a very beneficial way. She had spent that year kind of afraid that if she showed too much leg that people would immediately assume she was running, and because she wasn't sure she was, she didn't want to do that. So she kind of wasted 2006. He spent 2006 in kind of the optimal fashion in a lot of ways. He actually sort of started 2007 with certain advantages that people couldn't even see until the first quarter fundraising numbers came out in April of 2007, and he outraised Hillary Clinton, which was one of the things that no one ever expected to happen. And that was, I think, the moment when people realized that Obama was for real and had to be taken seriously.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
The fact was, as I said before, just briefly, she really hated Iowa, and Iowa didn't particularly like her. And because of the importance of the caucuses and because Obama basically bet his whole campaign on doing well there, she kept kind of pouring money and resources and time into it, even though she wasn't doing well and didn't feel comfortable there. Obama's victory, it actually raised the stakes on that race. And when Obama won, the whole race was kind of turned on its head. It was the first of the big game-changing moments in a lot of ways. Suddenly,
yes,
Barack Obama was the most next likely Democratic nominee and president of the United States.
Yeah, that was a remarkable moment. I'm one of those political junkies that followed this campaign with a microscope, so your book is quite compelling to me. Now, the stuff that you talk about in regard to the Clinton campaign, too, is how disorganized it was. The staff was feuding. They had tons of money, but they used it poorly. That was an amazing, almost indictment to Hillary Clinton's leadership.
Well, you know, I think it's a fair point, and, you know, to try to be fair to her, you know, she had seen her husband's campaign in 1992 be very fractious and very disorganized and full of feuds and disorganization and yet still be a winning campaign. She had worked with virtually all of the same people who were her senior leadership in 2008, had helped her win the Senate race in New York in 2000. That people didn't think she would win, but that she did, and then they had won her big reelection victory in 2006. So she had some reason to look at this group and say, you know, I know that there's disputes between some of these people. I know some people here don't like each other very much, but it doesn't seem to me from the lessons of my experience, I'm speaking here as Hillary Clinton, that those things are necessarily dispositive, that all of those problems will necessarily mean the campaign can't work.
Mm-hmm.
And so in some ways, instead of trying to quell that dissent within her campaign, she actually had a theory that in some ways the conflict in her campaign would produce the best possible results, that people would argue about things and then the best ideas would rise to the top. The problem in a lot of ways for her was that idea, this team of rivals that she thought that she was assembling, she didn't seem to understand that what she needed to do in the end, if you were going to have that kind of conflict, that you needed to be a strong leader. She needed to be able to step in the end and take control in a decisive way and then resolve those disputes and figure out, you know, among the competing ideas what the right one was, what the right strategy was. She never really did that. Her passiveness in the face of that conflict, internal conflict, was pretty devastating in terms of spending a lot of 2007 and then into part of 2008 not really having a clear strategy, not really having a clear message, not really knowing what she wanted to say about herself to the American people.
Yeah, that was remarkable to me. Now, it's very interesting in your book, you talk about how David Axelrod said that he didn't think Barack Obama had a pathological drive to be president. Do you think he was one of few who didn't? I thought that was a remarkable statement.
Yeah, well, you know, it's we write about it in the book in the context of Obama, you know, just about to pull the trigger and decide that he's going to run, and he comes back from his Christmas holiday in Hawaii at the end of 2006, early 2007. It's just a couple days after New Year's on 2007. He sits down with Axelrod and says, "Look, you know, I have a pretty nice life. You know, being Barack Obama isn't a bad deal. I'm not sure I want to be away from my family so much. I'm not sure I don't want to just be able to sit back and watch basketball on TV with my friends." And Axelrod's attitude is, you know, I know you want to be president, and I know you'd be a great president, but I'm not sure you need to be president in the way that people like Hillary Clinton, people like John Edwards, Axelrod had worked for both of those people, Hillary and John Edwards, and he said, look, these people are pathological. You know, they will get up every day and work 20 hours a day. They know exactly where they're going to be 6 months from now. If they have 103 fever, they will still go out and campaign as if their life depended on it. I'm not sure you're that crazy. And, you know, Obama's attitude was, you know, I'm not that crazy, but I refuse to believe that you have to actually be borderline clinically insane to run for president. We have to have a country here where sane people can become president of the United States.
That was heartwarming, yeah.
And he thought, you know, that in the end, one thing he knew about himself was that he was very competitive. And so although he knew that he wasn't as crazy or as pathological as some other people who would be running, he'd be running against, he did think that he was as competitive as anybody in politics, and he knew that if he got into the game, that his competitive juices would take over, and that would make him do the things that were required to win.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And he did indeed. Now, your revelations about both Elizabeth and John Edwards were startling to many. I mean, a lot of people have heard them now. But Elizabeth was thought of as this angelic helpmate, Saint Elizabeth, and you talk about the lie of Saint Elizabeth. So tell us about that. Were you startled by some of these revelations as well?
I think we were as startled as anybody else. I mean, you know, the extent that we knew Elizabeth Edwards, and, you know, both Mark and I knew her a little bit from having covered 2004 and 2008, you know, we had largely the same views the public had, which was that, you know, she was, she was really his better half. And I mean that not in just in the sense in their relationship, but in the sense of, you know, politically, she was her husband's greatest political asset. A lot of people really looked up to Elizabeth Edwards. She, of course, is a woman who gets and deserves enormous sympathy. She's had a very, very difficult life in many respects, having lost, you know, a child to a tragic auto accident, having suffered through a couple bouts of cancer, and then, of course, later her husband's very public infidelity. At the same time, you know, when we talked to people who were Among the Edwards' closest friends, we talked to all the staff members who worked for her, staff members who worked for him, people who observed them at close range over many years. You know, the universal, unanimous consensus view was this woman, the gap between her public image and her private reality was as great as there has ever been for anybody in public life, and that she was a very difficult character. She had a volcanic temper. She could be very abusive and dismissive of the staff that worked for them, but more disturbingly for people, very harsh and dismissive of her husband. And, you know, we report in the book her reference to her husband as a hayseed and his parents as hicks, people who would say to them, when one instance someone saying, you know, oh, John, you know, have you read the following book? And before Edwards would have a chance to answer, Elizabeth would break in sort of laughing and say, well, you know, John, my husband doesn't read books.
And then that
you know,
was frightening.
I'm the one in the family who reads the books.
That was a frightening revelation in itself, the thought that somebody who might be president doesn't read books. No, in retrospect, it's really hard to understand how destructive Edwards was. And his campaign staff went along with it. There was so much at stake. What do you make of that?
There are a number of things to say about that. You have to first understand the degree of devotion that people who work for presidential candidates have. I mean, they devote, you know, days, weeks, months, years of their lives in some cases to trying to make the person that they think would be the best president into the president. And they, you know, have devoted that much time. It's very hard, I think, for anybody. Like if you're in a bad marriage, you know, you've devoted so much time, effort, and energy to keeping the relationship alive. It's sometimes hard to let go, even when you know that the relationship has soured or the person that you're married to is turned bad in some way.
Mm-hmm.
And I also think for a lot of those people, I mean, there were some of them who did sort of step away. A lot of the people from the 2004 campaign, as we report in the book, when they saw Edwards' behavior, particularly around Raelle Hunter, started to drift away from the campaign in an inconspicuous fashion. But I think the most important thing, you know, as the Iowa caucuses started to get close and as the Inquirer started to get on the story about Edwards' infidelities, you know, a lot of the people around him who did recognize the stakes and who did think that there was a danger that if Edwards won Iowa, he could eventually win the nomination, that eventually all of these things about him would become public and it would be a disaster for the Democratic Party. Those people, A, they thought, you know, that if he won Iowa, they might have to go come public with some of what they knew. But the reason that they were so hesitant in a lot of cases wasn't even out of loyalty to Edwards or loyalty to their own efforts, but in a lot of cases was about loyalty to the kids. And their view was, you know, the Edwards children, they loved those kids, and they thought, you know, it would be better to spare them the public humiliation of what was going to happen to their father if it was avoidable. And their hope was that, you know, in some ways their dark hope was Edwards will lose in Iowa, he'll have to drop out of the race, and none of this, maybe none of this will ever become public, and we won't have to do that dirty bit of business, and that way the kids will be spared.
If you're just joining us, my guest is John Heilman. He's co-author of the best-selling book, Game Change, and that's exactly what we're talking about right now. Now, you portray Raelle Hunter, or the people that you've talked to, as someone who was actually crazy. They thought she was truly crazy. Tell us about that.
Well, they did. I mean, you know, I think they thought she was flighty and very eccentric, for sure. Crazy probably overstates it a little bit, but, you know, she was a very New Agey woman. She came up to people occasionally and described herself as a witch. She was very
that was very funny.
She was very flirtatious with most of the men that she met. She was very over familiar with a lot of people, and people thought she was she kind of intruded on their space in a way that they found rather strange. And you know she had all kind of like psychic intuitions about Chris Matthews, and you know she had her quirks and eccentricities for sure. But, you know, for them, I think, again, you know, the main thing that people thought was, you know, who is this woman? You know, and what is she, why is she around, and why is she spending so much time with John Edwards? And you know, there was the dynamic that they saw was that he had installed her, you know, as his videographer and was treating her like a combination of a senior advisor and a spouse. And for a lot of the people around Edwards, you know, they thought that was strange because this woman, not just because of her eccentricities, but because she seemed dangerous to them in some way. And then they started to have suspicions about what must be going on between the two of them, given the kind of power that she was assuming within the campaign in terms of her proximity to Edwards.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, I think the country is lucky that he did not win. Now let's talk about John McCain. A maverick, well-respected, has had a stellar career in many ways. He just seemed so angry and out of touch during this campaign. To tell us a little bit about what you learned.
Well, I think in a lot of ways, you know, John Edwards is a very, there's certain similarities to Hillary Clinton that you kind of see in the book. And you know, one of them was that, you know, he really, you know, after McCain lost in 2000, in the 2000 Republican nomination fight to George W. Bush, he never really thought he'd run for president again. And certainly his wife, Cindy, who was very scarred by the experience that they had had in 2000, some of the negative campaigning that involved her and her children on the part of the Bush campaign, she felt that, you know, she didn't want to go back and do that again. She thought it was an experience she did not want to relive. And so McCain entered the 2008 race. He got kind of pulled into it by a party that didn't have an obvious front runner. He was reticent and reluctant about getting in. His wife was more than reticent and reluctant, was trying to stop him from running. And I think, you know, the only way for the people around him, their attitude was, you know, if you're going to do this, you are going to be the front runner, and you need to run like a front runner. And so they built a campaign around him that he was profoundly uncomfortable with. You know, McCain, you used the word maverick. Certainly he's a guy who prefers to fly by the seat of his pants than live within a big, bureaucratic, overly structured apparatus. And that's exactly the kind of campaign that his advisors tried to build around him. They tried to build a campaign like George W. Bush's campaigns in 2000 and 2004. And McCain, being the kind of person he is, very hot-tempered, very reactive, he sort of rebelled against his own campaign to a large extent. And so for much of 2007, you see this guy who is almost like he's walking around in a suit of clothes that are very itchy and very scratchy and kind of annoying him all the time. Everything about how the campaign was structured kind of bothered him. And he refused to do a lot of the things that you need to do if you're going to run that kind of campaign. He refused to do a lot of fundraising. He refused to do a lot of the stuff on the road that they wanted him to do. And so the campaign basically imploded in the summer of 2007. Mm-hmm. And McCain, only then in some ways, only when his whole political apparatus was in ruins, was he able to go back to being the kind of John McCain that he liked to be, which was, you know, the guy who carries his own bags and is basically driving around the country in an old jalopy, you know, doing town hall meetings and not encumbered with all the expectations and all of the organizational edifice that had come along with his earlier front runner status. And that in some ways is when John McCain is at both his best and his happiest. And you see, you know, his success in the Republican nomination fight was very much a function of the fact that he had finally found a way to be campaigning that he was actually happy and comfortable with. You know, in the general election, we could spend some time on that if you want, but, you know, the earlier McCain, the campaign from the McCain from the earlier part of 2007 sort of comes back. And look, I think, you know, the biggest problem for McCain, you know, in the end, psychologically, was he knew through most of the general election that he was going to lose, and or at least he was very likely to lose. And the combination of the fact that he was running in a year where it was going to be very difficult for any Republican, where he was going to be painted as a clone of George W. Bush, which he thought was unfair, and it bothered him. And then the fact that he was running against Barack Obama, who he felt the same way about that Hillary Clinton felt, which was that this guy was manifestly unqualified to be president and had no business standing on the same stage beside John McCain. Felt like he'd never sacrificed for his country, felt like he didn't have the experience, didn't know that much about policy, didn't know anything about foreign policy. It was maddening to McCain, and so to lose in that environment, I think, made him the grumpy figure that you saw through much of the fall.
Yeah. Now, obviously, the pick of Sarah Palin stunned everyone, but your research really revealed how reckless McCain was in this instance. They truly did not vet this woman. Tell us about this. McCain was 72 years old, had had cancer. This woman could have become president.
And not just cancer. He had cancer three times. The two things that Sarah Palin was a big surprise to most everybody when she was picked. And, you know, one of the two things that the McCain campaign told the world at the time and told us, you know, contemporaneously was that she had been on the short list of vice presidential candidates the whole summer, and that they had given her as much scrutiny and vetting as they did to any of the other people on the short list. We, in the course of reporting the book, Mark Halperin and I, you know, discovered that both those two things were not just misleading, but were really bald-faced lies, that she had not been on the short list or on any list for most of the summer, and that when they actually chose her, they really did less vetting on her than you would do for a deputy assistant secretary of agriculture. She was...
That's amazing.
There's a whole story about how they ended up getting to her, and it goes primarily to the notion of McCain thinking that all of the apart from Joe Lieberman, who he really wanted to put on the ticket, but which proved to be impossible because he was seen as too liberal by much of the Republican base, you know, apart from Joe Lieberman, all the rest of the candidates McCain thought were really solid candidates, but they wouldn't do enough to help him in a very bad political environment. So he needed something that he thought would be a game changer, and turned to Palin in a slightly desperate way. You know, the lack of vetting was stunning to us. I mean, they did, you know, she was not put into consideration until 4 days before McCain had to make his choice. His self-imposed deadline was upon him. You know, she was not, until the night before he chose her, she was not interviewed by any of his senior advisors or his vetting chief, the lawyer who was running his selection committee. No one talked to her husband. No one talked to her political enemies. No one traveled to Alaska to do research or interviews on the ground in Alaska to find out what her political opponents thought of her or what her background was. She had filled out her vetting questionnaire in a totally hasty way. This is a 77-part document that Mitt Romney took a month and a half and a team of lawyers and accountants to fill out. She did it in a couple of hours and incompletely.
That's unbelievable.
I mean, it's pretty amazing. And I think, you know, the main thing to say about it is that it really ill-served both her and McCain, because the truth is there is no vice presidential nominee, no matter who you are, who is not going to require a full-throated and well-sustained and well-supported defense. Every vice presidential candidate is going to be attacked. Every vice presidential candidate has weaknesses, has vulnerabilities. In order to be able to convince the American people that this person is ready to be president, in order to beat back the attacks of your political rivals, you need to understand who this person is. You need to know their vulnerabilities. You need to know how to defend them. They didn't have any of that information available about Sarah Palin, and so she was left open to attack in a way that, as I say, ill-served her. And, you know, McCain was basically buying a pig in a poke. He didn't really know her at all when he picked her, and so he left himself vulnerable to attacks that he had not taken this decision seriously. Those attacks were accurate, and it made him seem like a cynical person. This is the basic test that we ask of these people when they pick vice presidential candidates, is can this person succeed you if something bad happens to you? I think a lot of people looked at this choice and saw it as transparently political, and that hurt McCain's image with a lot of voters who thought that he was someone who took politics and took this responsibility seriously. Picking Sarah Palin in this hasty way made people think, you know, this guy's obviously not taking this job as seriously as he should.
Well, I was taken by the fact that once her handlers started trying to help her and get her ready for debates and so on, found out how little she knew. That shocked me. Because you would think just somebody who ran and won a governorship would have at least basic information about American history and so on. But she apparently did not.
The McCain people are as shocked as you are, Tisha. And they literally, again, as the flipshodness of the vetting process, one of the things, because they were on such a tight timeline, one of the things that they assumed was that she would be somewhere close to the median or the mean, the average, of a governor. You know, they knew she wouldn't know as much about foreign policy as someone who'd been a senator, for instance, and they accepted that. They thought, you know, she's the governor of Alaska. She's not going to know a ton about foreign policy. We're going to have to teach her some of that stuff. That's fine. But they assumed that she would know as much as the average governor about domestic policy, and they assumed that she would know as much as the average American, at least, or the average educated American, about basic concepts in American history and in American government and politics. And what they discovered as they started to prep her for debate, as you say, was that she was well below the mean. She was well below the average. She was someone who really lacked a lot of really basic rudimentary understanding, not just in the area of foreign policy, but in domestic policy and American history, and they were sort of stunned by... Not that she was stupid. It was not like a question of her intellectual capacity. It was more that she was information poor. You know, she had, and that was, you know, was something that, you know, as you know, they remedied it well enough. She managed to get through, apart from the Katie Couric interviews, which were devastating for her. She got through a lot of her other network interviews, and she managed to get through the debate with Joe Biden without committing any major gaffes.
That was amazing.
But I do think that those substantive deficiencies, combined with some of what turned out to be her temperamental deficiencies, which we can talk about if you like, but the substantive plus the temperamental deficiencies were part of the reason why, as we say in the book, a lot of the people who were very much involved in getting her on the ticket came to the conclusion by the end of the campaign that if McCain somehow won, they would have to have a very difficult conversation with him where they said, look, she can be a ceremonial vice president, but she can't be a real vice president. Mm-hmm. You can't expect her to be a vice president in the mold of Dick Cheney or the mold of Al Gore. She's not going to be that kind of vice president because, as I say, they realized at that point, with some degree of guilt, that they realized that they had put someone on the ticket who was neither substantively nor temperamentally actually suited to the office.
Yeah, that's remarkable. It is absolutely remarkable to me. Now, both the Clintons and the McCain campaigns, and I want to ask you this both in regard to this book and in regard to the fact that both you and Mark Halperin were journalists during this campaign, that they thought the press gave Obama a free ride in many ways. Well, what are your impressions?
Well, I think there's two answers to the question. I mean, there are two different things. You're exactly right in that the McCain, it's yet another way in which Hillary Clinton and John McCain had similarities. And, you know, there are many others, and you know that they were friendly and had looked forward to running against each other. But one of the ways in which they're very similar was the sense of their sense of grievance about the media coverage of the campaign. And there are two aspects of that, one of which I think is fair and one of which I think is not fair. The part that's fair is their assertion that Barack Obama lived a pretty charmed life in terms of the kind of media coverage that he got and the kind of scrutiny that he received in the course of his campaign. I think it's very hard to argue that Obama was not a darling of the press, and that a lot of the press, because they were impressed with him as a performer, they were swept up to some extent, the historic nature of his candidacy. They went fairly easy on Obama, and there were many instances in which he was not subject to the same rigors of press scrutiny that other front runners and later nominees received in the course of running for president. So I think that part of the complaint is fair. The part I think is unfair is the notion that McCain and Hillary Clinton had, which was that the press treated them unfairly, and that the press was unduly harsh in dealing with their candidacies. And I think that in the case of both Hillary Clinton and John McCain, that the press did its job and was tough with them, but was suitably tough with them. And I think many of the things that they called McCain and Clinton out on were legitimate sources of criticism. And in a funny way, I think both McCain and Hillary Clinton, they mismanaged. I mean, like, one of the fundamental jobs of any presidential candidate is the management of their public image. And a big part of the problem for McCain was that his behavior and some of the policies and proposals and some of the things that he did in the campaign seemed to be at variance with what people thought he was like. You know, he had always been the good housekeeping seal in American politics and this image as a maverick. When he started to behave more like a conventional Republican, people rightly pointed out that there was a discrepancy between those things. McCain to this day doesn't see the discrepancy, but I think the discrepancy is there, and the press was right to call him out on those things. Hillary Clinton had another problem, which was that she had this caricature of her as this cold, calculating, Machiavellian figure who would do anything to win. And she all too often, either she or her campaign, did things in the course of the campaign that added further fuel to those stereotypes. And so I think that's another instance in which she did not take care. She was aware of those stereotypes, but then seemed to walk into them rather than deflecting them. And so on that subject also, the press pointing those things out, I think, is perfectly fair game. And so, as I say, my judgment is basically they're 50% right and 50% wrong on the press coverage of the race.
John, we only have about 30 seconds left. You interviewed more than 200 people, mostly conducted in what journalists call deep background, meaning you weren't going to reveal your sources. Do you think you got the story?
We've been really most heartened by the fact that, you know, it's a 450 or 460 page book. We did, as you said, all those interviews. And the thing that's been most heartening about the reception of the book is that, some people have loved it and some people have not loved it. But the one thing we haven't had is people who've found that we've made actual errors in the book. There's been virtually no pushback on any of the facts that are in the book, and that ultimately is where the proof is. The proof is in the pudding on a book like this, whether you got it right. And a lot of these people in the book have very loud megaphones. If we had gotten things wrong, well, we would have heard about it, and we haven't.
That's true. Well, John Heilman, thank you so much for joining us. And again, the book is called Game Change. It's riveting. I recommend it to everyone. And thank you so much, John Heilman.
Thank you, Tish.
Keep up your journalistic work. Love it.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. If you'd like to make a tax-deductible donation in support of the Out of Bounds radio show, please contact our fiscal sponsor, the Arts of the Southern Finger Lakes, at earts.org. That's earts.org. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. We'll be back next week. I'm Tish Perlman.